there's very little fact-checking. But one of the things that X is supposed to still have is fake AI-generated stuff should be tagged as AI-generated tagged material. So he didn't even do that. He said it was a joke. I'd be laughing at him harder if I wasn't spending so much money on this idiocy. Got a something from Laura Flanders I'm going to excerpt. Laura Flanders and Friends now on your podcast sources. Long time, actually, she thinks she started out with Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting many, many decades ago. Irish by birth. Met her at a conference in Ireland, as I mentioned last week when I played a segment. What else is on the rundown? Well, yesterday on Democracy Now! There was a thing so salient, I figure I should play it again, because I've been beating the drum about the what I call the 12th Amendment gamut. Constitutional lawyers, one of whom I talked to, was down from Chicago for the Friday Forum yesterday. Contingent election. The idea that for some reason or another, there's no electoral college majority. Enough votes were burnt in one state or another to not allow them to declare their votes. Impasse, and then goes to the House of Representatives. So that was discussed in some detail as a little secret that Trump and current Speaker of the House have together. I thought it was so salient. I should play it again. The main part of the second hour, half hour, is going to be Jeffrey Sachs talking about the BRICS conference just recently and doing a really good overview. If you heard Economic Update with Richard Wolff earlier, he talked about it a bit, and he's on this program with Danny Haiphong. I believe he's a Vietnamese-American. I remember him from years ago. Actually contributing to the Black Agenda report, so there you go. But he has three scholars, including Richard Wolff Sachs and a gentleman that I think he got in touch with in Singapore or something. I'm going to play just the part of the Jeffrey Sachs talk in the second half hour because it's another economic issue that isn't being talked about, it seems, in any of the discourse around electoral cycles, particularly. No commentary from me, Abu Jamal, again. I keep looking, but I'm not sure if he's fading away, or maybe he's working on another book and doesn't have time for commentary, so I don't know. He's co-written some stuff and co-anthologized some material recently. But here's Amy Goodman's Breaking the Sound Barrier. Probably about Madison Square Garden. Something I've been circulating in my mind and a little bit on Facebook is that not only is he, this so-called comedian, denigrating Puerto Ricans, he's making light of the pollution of the oceans. You know, there's a huge floating island of garbage. Aha.
Hatred and racism, Trump's ominous closing argument. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan and our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. Donald Trump made his closing argument at a Madison Square Garden rally in New York, the same city where he was recently convicted of 34 felonies. The spectacle was an orchestrated six-hour orgy of hate. Speaker after speaker worked the crowd by attacking immigrants, Jews, black people, women, and more, directing special invective against the woman of color challenging Trump, Vice President Kamala Harris. Celebrity white supremacist Tucker Carlson, for example, warned Harris could be
the first Samoan Malaysian low IQ former California prosecutor ever to be elected president.
The evening's opening act, a so-called comedian named Tony Hinchcliffe, set the tone with a vile racist routine.
There's literally a floating island of garbage in the middle of the ocean right now. Yeah. I think it's called Puerto Rico.
Hinchcliffe's crude shtick was vetted by the Trump campaign, since they reportedly deleted his intended use of the C word to describe Kamala Harris. There are more than 8 million Puerto Ricans in the United States, all of whom are U.S. citizens. Due to Puerto Rico's colonial status, though, the 3 million residents of Puerto Rico can't vote in the U.S. presidential election. But the more than 5 million who do live in the continental U.S. can. Of those, almost 500,000 live in the crucial swing state of Pennsylvania, with an additional 500,000 spread across the swing states of Georgia, North Carolina, Arizona, Wisconsin, Michigan, and Nevada. Puerto Rican voters are angry. As proud Puerto Rican Sunny Hostin, co-host of ABC's popular talk show The View, said the day after Trump's rally,
"We know how to take the trash out, Donald Trump. Trash that has been collecting since 2016. And that's you, Donald Trump. My fellow Puerto Ricans, trash collection day is November 5th, 2024.
Trump predictably referred to his rally as a love fest. He notoriously refuses to apologize for anything, and his invitations to the racist comedian or to any of the other inflammatory speakers at his rally are no exception. If his naked racism weren't enough, Trump has repeatedly said he wants to be a dictator. He admires dictators. He associates with dictators. He praises dictators.
This is the language of fascism and violence.
NYU history professor Ruth Ben-Ghiat said on the Democracy Now! NewsHour, she wrote the book Strong Men, Mussolini to the Present, and sees striking parallels between historical fascism and Trump's MAGA movement. Struck by the vulgarity from the podium throughout Trump's MSG rally, Ben-Ghiat said,
"We think about authoritarianism as imposing controls on people and silencing people, and it certainly does that. But it also is designed from fascism forward to make people become their worst selves, to give them permission to be as violent and unrestrained as possible. This kind of profanity at women, the misogyny, anti-Black statements, the calling Latinos garbage, it's not only a tradition of dehumanization that starts with fascism and goes through authoritarian movements up to our day. It's also designed to make people feel that the foot soldiers of MAGA, that there are no restraints, there are no controls, and everything will be accepted as long as it is in the service of targeting the enemy within."
Ben-Ghiat was referring to Trump's pledge to target the enemy within, as he has said repeatedly, like this on Fox News.
"The bigger problem are the people from within. We have some very bad people. We have some sick people, radical left lunatics. And it should be very easily handled by, if necessary, by National Guard, or if really necessary, by the military."
Several top military appointees from the former Trump administration have warned against a second Trump presidency. Ben-Ghiat observed,
"Retired military officers, especially generals, don't speak out unless they feel there's a real need to do so. And the fact we're seeing General Kelly, General Milley, former Defense Secretary Esper, speak out and use the F word, calling Trump a fascist, means that they are highly concerned."
Last Sunday was not the first time fascists gathered at Madison Square Garden. In 1939, the German-American Bund brought 20,000 people there to celebrate the rise of Nazi Germany. 7 years ago, filmmaker Marshall Curry assembled archival footage into the short documentary A Night at the Garden, which received an Oscar nomination.
"When I first saw that footage, I was completely shocked to see the American flag and George Washington and, you know, hear people singing the Star-Spangled Banner and saying the Pledge of Allegiance and then offering a stiff-armed salute and cheering white supremacy."
Curry explained on Democracy Now!, "The U.S. government has far too often undermined democracies abroad, leading to dictatorships or military regimes from Iran to Guatemala to Congo to Chile. Now, with a right-wing Supreme Court doing Trump's bidding and the potential for a compliant, MAGA-controlled Congress, only a galvanized, engaged electorate supported by resilient, pro-democracy grassroots movements can prevent autocracy from coming home to roost." I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
"Asking his people, go out to vote, and stop with this nonsense, because we're going to be counting ballots for the next 2 years. And I don't want to end up in the Supreme Court, and I don't want to go back to Congress either. Even though we have an advantage if we go back to Congress. Does everyone understand that? I think it's 26 to 22 or something, because it's counted one vote per state. So we actually have an advantage. Oh, they're going to be thrilled to hear that. I'm sure they're trying to figure out how can we break that one. Biden wants to confiscate your guns and indoctrinate your children with poisonous anti-American lies in schools, right?"
That was Trump seeing that his crowd had lost interest or were befuddled by his talking about the 12th Amendment. He was briefed. And now it's called A Little Secret or something, which is pretty amazing. It's in the 12th Amendment. But it isn't really being talked about much. Longtime friend of the show, Greg Palast, had been talking about it for a long time, and I recount the story about how he wrote about it for Salon, and they said it was too conspiratorial. But now it's a little bit taken seriously. And here's interview that Amy did with Eli Mistel, writes for The Nation, has a black man's response to the Constitution or something. He doesn't like it. Yeah. This was aired yesterday, but so right on. I got to do it again here in case you missed it. Or I want to think about it some more.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, War, Peace, and the Presidency. I'm Amy Goodman. We end today's show with the nation's justice correspondent, Elie Mystal, whose new piece out this week is headlined, That Little Secret Between Trump and Johnson? Here's what it could mean. It refers to a comment Trump made at his racist Madison Square Garden rally in New York last Sunday about how House Speaker Mike Johnson could help install Trump as a president through a contingent election in which the House, not the Electoral College, determines the president.
You know, with me, we got to get the congressman elected and we got to get the senators elected because we can take the Senate pretty easily. And I think with our little secret, we're going to do really well with the House, right? Our little secret is having a big impact. He and I have a secret. We'll tell you what it is when the race is over.
He and I have a secret. We'll tell you what it is when the race is over. And clearly, President Trump is concerned. Pieces in the Washington Post, Politico headline, Trump lagging an early vote with seniors in Pennsylvania, a red flag for GOP. For more, we go to Elie Mystal. He is author of Allow Me to Retort, A Black Guy's Guide to the Constitution. Elie, welcome back to Democracy Now! Okay, what is this little secret?
Yeah, so it's really the 12th Amendment. One of the reasons you have to ask yourself, why is Donald Trump and his group of MAGA people stomping around the country, calling Puerto Ricans garbage, and generally acting like they don't need to get any more votes to win the presidency? And the reason why they think that they don't need any more votes is comes from the 12th Amendment. The 12th Amendment is where you get to these contingent election scenarios. What the 12th Amendment says is that the winner of the presidency is determined by whoever has a majority of the electoral votes among the electors appointed. Right. And that's the key phrase. If you do not get to a majority among the electors appointed, then you kick it to the House. And that's where you have the contingent election, where, importantly, the House votes based on its own state delegation. So basically, every state gets one vote. Currently, there are 26 delegations that are Republican, 24 Democrats. So Trump would win in that contingent election of the House. But that's not the secret. The secret is that if you decrease the number of electors appointed, right, the math is simple, that the majority of electoral votes that you need also goes down. So in a very simple case where we think it is you need 270 electoral votes to win if there are 538 total electors. But if you take that number down to, say, 528 electors, well, then all of a sudden you only need 264 electoral votes to win, right? And you can do that. You can decrease the number of electors appointed if you prevent, delay, obfuscate the ability of any particular state to certify its elections and send electors to Congress by the statutorily required deadline of December 11th. And so, Amy, I think that's where this whole game is going to be played by Trump and Johnson. They're going to try to prevent states from submitting, states that Harris wins, from submitting valid states of slates of electors by the December 11th deadline. And then once we get to that deadline, Mike Johnson, as Speaker of the House, and Republicans in control of the House, will simply call the process over and say any electors not appointed by the statutory deadline of December 11th simply don't count. And that is a way for Trump to steal an election that he loses.
For people who are watching this globally, Elie, for people who don't understand the Electoral College, and there are movements to change it, like the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact, designed to ensure that the candidate who received the most votes nationwide as elected president would come into effect only when it could guarantee that outcome. What this system is that we have that they're finagling with right now?
Yeah, so for people who are not from America, who are, like, trying to figure out what's going on, I believe the scientific term for the Electoral College is stupid. Right? The Electoral College is anti-democratic and dumb. If you're living in some other country and you have been told that America is the greatest democracy on earth, you have been sold a lie. We are not the greatest democracy on earth. We are not even a true democracy because of the Electoral College, right? The Electoral College, which has always been a part of our history, of our nation, it's always been part of the structure of the government, is fundamentally an anti-democratic system for the single elected official, the single representative that is supposed to be elected by all the people of the United States, right? Everybody else, it's based on their county, their town, their state. The president of the United States is the one official that's supposed to be elected by everybody, but he's actually elected by he or she one day, hopefully soon, is elected by nobody because of the Electoral College. It is a ridiculous system. It's an anachronistic system, basically, you know, like so much else in the Constitution, made to, it's another one of those poison pills the enslavers put into the original Constitution in hope that it would make it very difficult for slavery to ever be outlawed in this nation. And while we overcame slavery, its fundamental structure of allowing for minoritarian white rule is still in place, and we still see the effects, and that's what we're looking at in this election. You got to remember, Donald Trump is most likely, you know, regardless of what happens on Tuesday in the Electoral College, Donald Trump is almost certainly going to lose the popular vote for the third time. For the third time in a row, this man will have a minority of the popular vote, yet still could be president either by winning the Electoral College outright or by gaming the system, as I've outlined in my piece in The Nation.
Tell us more about what you wrote about deadlines. That what this means is that Republicans just have to delay long enough to pass those deadlines. They don't have to win. They just have to stall. And we're seeing more and more across this country these complicated local election laws that have to do with counting. You know, we're doing an election special at night, an election special the next morning, when we very possibly might not know what the election results are, even the next morning.
Yeah, delay, delay, delay is the name of the game for the Republicans. Statutorily speaking, electors have to be submitted to Congress by December 11th. Statutorily speaking, those electors have to vote and then submit their votes on who the president should be by December 25th, Christmas Day, because we are that kind of stupid, right? January 3rd is when the new House takes office. That's a constitutional deadline, so no shenanigans are applicable there. And January 6th, as the violent MAGA people know, is the date when the House certifies the results of the Electoral College vote. But that date is largely ceremonial. Even Mike Pence understands that date is largely ceremonial. The real action is on between December 11th, when the electors are appointed, and December 25th, when they're supposed to be done voting. Now, those deadlines are statutory. That means they can be changed. And if you roll the tape back to 2020, when Nancy Pelosi is the Speaker of the House and the Democrats control the House, one would imagine that if states had gotten cute with their, you know, delaying submitting their slates of electors, Nancy Pelosi would have just extended the deadline. But this is why Speaker of the House Mike Johnson is critical to Trump's secret plan to steal the election. Because if Mike Johnson's in charge, which he absolutely will be, even if Democrats win the House, Mike Johnson's in charge on December 11th. If he's in charge then, he could not move the deadline, essentially, and declare the process over. Now, let's say Democrats win the House, right? Let's say January 3rd, Democrats come in, Hakeem Jeffries is the new Speaker of the House. Could the Democrats undo what Mike Johnson has done on December 11th and December 25th? Maybe, but as my colleague John Nichols just reminded us all, Democrats probably ain't going to control the Senate on January 3rd, so you generally need a bicameral proposition to move deadlines like that. You're probably not going to have the Senate, even if the Democrats win the House. But more importantly, and you know, people who know my beat will not be surprised about what I'm about to say, but if you set the deadline on December 25th, and on December 25th you say, okay, Trump is the president now, because we didn't count the electors from Wisconsin and we didn't count the electors from Pennsylvania, let's say that happens, right? Well, now Hakeem Jeffries comes in, we change the rules, whatever, that's called a lawsuit, right? And that ends up in front of the Republican-controlled Supreme Court, which we have already seen go to great lengths to protect Donald Trump, to protect his candidacy, and to protect his ability to become president again. So even if Jeffries and the Democrats win the House and take over on January 3rd, by then you're putting it all into, like, all roads lead to the Supreme Court, and the Republicans, MAGA Republicans and their wives, control the Supreme Court. So, as I say in my piece, I mean, you're... Everybody likes to say, like, we're close to a constitutional crisis now. We in a constitutional crisis now, bro. And what happens after that, it's anyone's guess.
Ellie, you have an interesting piece in The Nation. Black men will vote for Harris. White men are the problem. I mean, I think a lot of the emphasis came when President Barack Obama started to appeal to black men. You say, why is the media talking so much about the fraction of black men who might go MAGA when more than 60% of white men will vote for Trump?
Yeah, I think the focus on black men has been a complete media, you know, red herring, right? People have been worried about it. I saw a poll recently or post recently saying, like, it looks like Trump's support with black men could be evaporating. Evaporating? It was never there. All right, Trump is going to get the same black men to vote for him who voted for him last time, who voted for him in 2016, who voted for him, who voted for Mitt Romney in 2012, who voted for John McCain in 2008. He's going to get 10 to 15% of the black male vote because there are 10 to 15% of black males are Republicans. And they like Republican things, like shooting Liz Cheney, apparently. That's a Republican thing that apparently a lot of black men, that 15% of black men like. But that's it. And that's always it. And it's never more than that, right? Conversely, we live in a country where somewhere around 60% of white men will vote for the adjudicated rapist Donald Trump. And that is our problem in this country, not the 10 to 12 to 15% of black men who are going to vote Republican.
Ellie Mistal, we want to thank you for being with us, the nation's justice correspondent. We'll link to all your pieces, including that little secret between Trump and Johnson. Here's what it could mean. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
And he only talks a little bit slower than that in real life. I'm accelerating things a little bit because I do want to get a lot of the Jeffrey Sachs on in the second half hour. And this segment from Laura Flanders and Friends. Which I will go directly to. Oh, that's right. I want to put an underwriting announcement in somewhere in the middle of the show. And maybe I'll also mention the concert tonight. It's a WEF-sponsored concert with Troubadour local and presenter Kevin Elliott opening at the First Mennonite Church. That's on the corner of Springfield and Lincoln. That's tonight at 6:30. A lot of offerings around town tonight, but this one is a benefit concert. And the headliner, of course, I should say that. It's the top of the item here, Alice DeMichele. I believe that's how it's said. Benefit concert for Red Cloud Renewable Lakota Tiuya Dome House Project. So you can go to redcloudrenewable.org to find out more about that. And sponsors are WEF, Faith in Place, New Prairie Solar, and the First Mennonite Church, again on the corner of Lincoln and Springfield, where there's a lot of parking available, 6:30 tonight. Hoping to make it. I guess, yeah, I'll put a sock in it there, and we'll go to Laura Flanders with her little collage to start off the show. I didn't check, but last week I played a segment, and she had a longer presentation available on her podcast availability. So she does a half-hour radio edit, and there may be a longer version of this one, too. But we're only going to hear about 8 minutes of this to get a sample and hear an actionality of a program she's hyping. And then we'll get to Jeffrey Sachs, interviewed by Danley Haifong, though he is mostly Jeffrey Sachs, giving a lesson on the BRICS and a lot of other things. We'll only hear a bit of that, too. I'll let you know where you can find that. It's on YouTube at Danny Haifong's YouTube channel. Haifong spelled like the Vietnamese town, I believe. Oh, and well, why don't I do the underwriting announcement here too? I'm supposed to get two in. And this isn't the one for Elliott Counseling, but that'll come up at the end of the show. Speaking of the end of the show, Radio Free Labor coming in. I hope it's a full compliment. We need the insight that the triumvirate can bring to us.
Support for WEFT programming is made possible in part by Bash Pepper Roofing. Large or small, they cover them all, commercial or residential. Bash Pepper Roofing offers roofing and re-roofing, gutters, siding, and door needs. For more information, 217-352-2200 or online at bashpepper.com.
Programming at WEFT.
It says single up there. I don't know what happened. Okay, Laura Flanders and Friends.
We are actually really powerful.
The place where the people who say it can't be done.
People rose up together in solidarity.
Take a back seat to the people who are doing it.
The power is information. The power is connectivity.
Forward-thinking interviews with leading thinkers and doers.
Naomi Klein.
Scott Nakagawa.
Dee. Vangelis.
Naomi Beatsovianshia.
From the worlds of politics, arts, and entrepreneurship.
Change happens by acting as though the future that you are dreaming of is present now.
I'm Laura, and this is Laura Flanders and Friends. Welcome.
I came away astounded at what I learned after spending, you know, more than a year with paramilitary and political violence in America. And I think that it's our jobs to dial up the volume as much as possible. And I think that that's what we're doing.
We need to provide support systems for each other, because a lot of right-wing media and a lot of mainstream media is actually very, very well-funded, but left-wing and movement journalism is actually very poor and very underfunded.
Election 2024 is happening in a media environment unlike any other. Local newspapers are closing at a rate of a dozen a month, and the churn in the digital media space is constant. Meanwhile, campaign ads are spreading propaganda and lies that are all too easily infiltrating local reporting. So what is to be done? This month's Meet the BIPOC Press is co-hosted again by Kadia Tubman, disinformation reporter for Scripps News Broadcast Network. Kadia, you must be super busy. But here we're kind of talking not just about disinformation, but misinformation and a media environment that just seems terribly badly equipped to deal with it.
Laura, I'm incredibly busy, yes, for sure, but also very happy to join you again. I just want to set the context for all of us right now. According to a 2024 report from Northwestern University's Local News Initiative, over half of U.S. counties have zero or very limited access to reliable information, whether that's print or broadcast. And when we were talking about digital outlets with all the closings and the layoffs and everything that's going on, that they have even fallen short when it comes to covering local news and marginalized communities. So the question, of course, is where does that leave us? Well, I want us to think about campaign ads that are now flooding into this news vacuum. And that means that's people getting their political information from these ads because they're likely not getting it from a reliable source. And so since August, we know that it's been reported that Republicans have invested over $65 million in anti-trans TV ads alone. And some of those talking points in those ads are actually coming from dubious sources. And so clearly we need more than ever. We need media literacy tools. And we also need deep reporting from people who are in these communities that are critically impacted by this environment, but also this upcoming election. And thankfully, we have those local and independent and BIPOC media folks who are taking up the lead.
We've got some of those folks with us on the show today. We are joined by Lara Witt. She is the editor-in-chief of Prism and co-founder of the Movement Media Alliance, which is a new coalition of social justice-driven journalism outfits working collaboratively to strengthen their impact. And also with us, a returning guest, Imara Jones, the creator of Trans/Media. Her award-winning podcast, The Anti-Trans Hate Machine, just released a new season revealing how most media are entirely missing the relationship between anti-trans and anti-LGBTQ plus propaganda and political violence and efforts to destroy U.S. democracy. It's all connected, and I'm very glad to have you all with us.
As Laura just said, we are running up to the election and it's getting close. It's going to be days away. What are you both concerned about right now?
I mean, I think that one of the things that is keeping me up at night is this lack of understanding about the intersection between anti-trans disinformation, political violence, and paramilitary groups, and the way in which that is being congealed to help undermine democracy. And it's keeping me up at night because in these last 2 weeks, this combination of these ads that are being dropped, not only by Donald Trump, but also in Senate races across the country, where they are beginning to show some bite, such as in Tammy Baldwin's race in Wisconsin, as well as the continued incorporation and focus on anti-trans rhetoric in Trump speeches, to where he is indicating that among the groups that would be purged on day one would be trans people. I'm worried about what's being teed up for right after the election.
It seems like there is an air of desperation that we're getting to right now, that if you're trying to get those minimal votes that can take you over, you're going to throw whatever you can at the wall. I'm interested in, Lara, from what the work that you're doing in terms of meeting this moment, especially in talking about Israel and Palestine and trying to move that to the forefront. Do you see those issues being as presented up and down the ballot as we are hearing about trans issues?
No. Mostly because a lot of the framing around Palestine has been fully in support of Israel. You know, there might be like a small caveat of we are saddened by the humanitarian crisis. It's not a humanitarian crisis. It's a genocide. But ultimately, the Democrats are not scared of losing votes from the progressives. They don't seem to even care about them. They're just shifting right entirely. They're courting Republicans who might be disenchanted by Trump, who don't want to work with someone who's unwieldy as him. They're very much courting like old school Republicans rather than caring about the deep issues that are affecting our communities.
We're going to talk about media in this conversation, and I want to come back to that question, Imara. Both you and Lara are talking about stories that are in the news, events that happen, but there's something being missed in the coverage, and that really, you really distilled it in the episode of your season three of the anti-trans hate machine that talked about there's no such thing as a lone wolf and the relationship between propaganda and ginning up an atmosphere and actual real life against human beings violence.
Proud Boys have been showing up in more and more communities across America. Despite their frat boy image, the Proud Boys are among the most violent and confrontational paramilitary groups in America. And nearly half of all of the demonstrations of force by extremist organizations in 2023 alone took aim at the LGBTQ community, with particular ire for any gathering of people who exist outside of the gender binary. In 2016, Gavin McGinnis established the Proud Boys on his radio program, where he unveiled his vision of returning America to a traditional European patriarchal society. This patriarchal worldview has led them to find common cause with political leaders, especially Donald Trump. And as we saw on January 6th, Trump has embraced them too. So if Trump is sworn in as president in January 2025, he'll have an extrajudicial paramilitary organization at his fingertips.
What a press.
From anti-trans hate machine, I assume that's available as a podcast, and that was from Laura Flanders, and I'm excerpting her at the half hour here, because I do want to get on Danny Haifong's interview. It's a YouTube channel, Patreon supported and all that. I'm pretty sure he's the same one, though he looks young. Jeffrey Sachs is the interviewer. Richard Wolff is on this two-hour segment as well as somebody who I was trying to find out for, but the info that the producer has doesn't have anything except about Jeffrey Sachs, who I go to frequently. He was in the economic aftermath of the Yeltsin-Clinton pillage of Russia. He was in Poland mainly, and he developed a support plan for Poland. And he espoused one for Russia the same way, but it went nowhere. He's talked about espousing the shock doctrine, but actually he argues that that's not the case. Shock therapy for the economies coming out of whatever was over there, state capitalism at the time of the falling of the wall and all. So kind of a zealot, I guess. All right, here's the intro and a lot of discourse from Jeffrey Sachs. Radio Free Labor coming up. I mentioned that already. I'll mention it again. Hope everybody's fit and fiddle. Well, you too, listener, despite everything.
Who is here on Rumble, be sure to hit the like button as you come onto the stream. We have an incredible show today to cover the BRICS summit and all of the geopolitical and geoeconomic developments surrounding it. But we are going to get right started with Professor Jeffrey Sachs right now. Then we're going to have Victor Gao come on later, and then Professor Richard Wolff. But without further ado, I want to introduce Professor Jeffrey Sachs. Thank you so much again for coming on today. I really appreciate
it. My pleasure.
Well, let's talk about the BRICS summit, Professor Sachs. You are an economist. I know you do a lot of work at the United Nations around sustainability. I wanted to ask your opinion and reaction to what has been a momentous BRICS summit thus far, which began October 22nd and is ending October 24th. I wanted to ask you about specifically, there has been a lot of news coming out of this summit in regards to partner countries joining up, 13 more, all from the global south. There has been a BRICS Pay demo as well as a symbolic gesture of a BRICS currency being unveiled, and a lot of talk about reforming the financial system, the world financial system. And a lot of talk in the Western media about how Putin is not so isolated. There's been a lot of, from Bloomberg to BBC, talking about Vladimir Putin's presidency of the BRICS this year, showing how all these measures against Russia taken by the West have been failing. What have been your thoughts about this BRICS summit and where it is taking the world, geopolitics, and in particular, this question of Russia being isolated?
Well, maybe it's a good place to start with the West, so-called. What do we mean by the West? It's not exactly a geographical description. It means essentially the U.S.-led alliance in the world, mainly a military alliance, but also, of course, an economic alliance of sorts. And the West is the United States and Canada, Britain, the European Union, Japan, Korea, Australia, New Zealand, and a handful of other countries. And when you add it up, it's not a lot of the world. As I mentioned, 27 EU countries, Canada and the United States makes 29, Britain makes 30, Japan, Korea, 32, Australia, New Zealand makes 34. Throw in another six or so, you could throw in another 10 tiny island economies around the world that are, for one reason or another, tied to the U.S. or even in formal ways, like Micronesia. But when you add up the population, the U.S. is 335 million people, the EU, 450 million people, that's 800 million. Add in the rest, and maybe you're at 1.1 or 1.2 billion people in the West. And that is, in an 8 billion person world, about 15% of the world population. So where are the rest of the people? Well, of course, China and India, that's 2.8 billion right there. Africa, another 1.4 billion, that's 4.2 billion. So the African Union plus India plus China is more than half the world. And they're not part of the West. And when you then add in the rest of the developing world, the ASEAN countries, for example, 10 countries in Southeast Asia with a population of about 800 million people, the Central Asian countries, the West Asian countries, which are basically the Arab countries of the Middle East, plus Iran and a few others. Well, this is where the other 85% of the world ends up being, and they're not part of the Western world. There has been, of course, a certain hubris of the West for a long time. I'd say it's at least 200 years old that the West runs the world. That's coming to an end because not only do the population numbers not add up, but the GDP numbers don't add up either anymore. If you measure GDP, as I think is appropriate in many contexts, by what we call purchasing power adjusted dollars, China is already 25 or 30% larger than the United States economy in the aggregate, not per person, because it's four times the population, but in the aggregate. So now I can turn to the BRICS. The BRICS is 9 or 10 countries right now. There's a little bit of ambiguity, in my mind at least, of exactly where Saudi Arabia is in this situation, but they're going to add more. And in the meeting today, that was a head of state, mainly roundtable discussion, there were 36 countries around the table. Those 36 countries, I added it up just earlier, was 57% of the world population just at the table. Measured in purchasing power prices, it was 46% of world output at the table. In other words, this is really a very significant part of the world. It's a larger part of the world than the Western world, in fact. Now, the West has believed that it dominates, and within the West, the United States believes it dominates because of its dominant military power, which is no doubt very strong. But what we see on the battlefield in Ukraine shows that it's not so dominant. Russia is actually, of course, defeating Ukraine on the battlefield. I say, of course, because it was completely predictable. The numbers are on Russia's side when it comes to military forces, not a surprise, but the NATO countries, and led by the United States, have poured in a lot, tens of billions of dollars of very sophisticated armaments, but nothing that was in the slightest decisive in defeating Russia. So this idea that the West, even if it doesn't dominate in population numbers or in GDP shares anymore, it still dominates in military power, not so true. And we're seeing also with Israel, and the its mass destructive power, no doubt, in Gaza and in Lebanon, But Israel's not defeating even Hamas. It's not defeating Hezbollah. It certainly is not going to win a direct war with Iran, where the population is more than 10 times larger. And Iran is a very sophisticated military power with the ballistic missiles, with the hypersonic missiles, and with a strong alliance with Russia. So all of this shows that we arrived before our eyes at a different world in the last 10 years. And it's happening right now. And the BRICS is this story, that the dominance of the West, which it's a little hard to date precisely, it's at least, of course, been since 1800. Arguably, it's been since 1700, because from 1700 onward, the West won all the wars that it was in with the rest of the world, by not all of them, but by and large, it was able to take territory, win colonies, and so forth, until after World War II. And the West has felt, well, this is a Western-led world. That's over. And the BRICS is a vivid sign of it being over. I thought it was over before today's meeting in Kazan, but today's meeting goes right along with that general point.
Yes, yes, of course. And all of those points are definitely well taken, Professor Sachs. And one thing I wanted to ask you about is how did we exactly get here, especially in recent years? Because at the summit, the BRICS countries weren't really talking about Ukraine. They weren't talking about, there was, of course, mention of Ukraine very sparingly. There was also, of course, statements made about what's happening in Gaza and West Asia. But at the same time, there was a lot more talk about development, about trade, and about how, especially in the case of these countries like Iran, like Russia and China, how all of these countries that were at the table are going to work together for a more prosperous and multipolar world. Putin and Xi Jinping met on the sidelines. Xi Jinping and Narendra Modi met on the sidelines, and they struck a historic deal on the border tensions that they have between those two countries. So talk about how we got here, because there seems to be a completely different trajectory being charted, and it's being led by Russia and China, and yet and Iran as well, and India. But many of these countries have received the ire of the West, and yet it doesn't seem to be working.
Well, I think there are two senses of the question: how did we get here? One is, how is it that the non-Western world has made so much advance in technology, military power, state organization, economic size? And the second question is, how is it that the BRICS went from a label given by an economist at Goldman Sachs, different Sachs, by the way, just to be clear, at Goldman Sachs, to a geopolitical entity? So two different points. But the first one I want to mention is that all of economic history, dating back 2,000 years plus, shows that at various points, one region of the world gains some technological advantage and is able even to conquer other major parts of the world. But the advantage that made those conquests possible are not permanent advantages, because the conquered nations learn from them, technologies diffuse, other innovations take hold. And so nobody stays on top forever. And when you look at the Western-led world, the West was not in the lead in the world. The West, meaning Western Europe in particular, was a kind of appendage of Eurasia for a long time. During the Roman Empire in Western Europe, of course, it was a very powerful unit. But if you looked at the year 1000 AD, the West was coming out of still the collapse of the Western Roman Empire, whereas in the East, you had great empires and sophistication and a larger knowledge base and more philosophy and arts and other things occurring. So there was no sense in which the West was ahead. The West begins to show its role after the so-called voyages of discovery, if you want to call them that, of Christopher Columbus and Vasco da Gama, 1498 and 1492, respectively, and the beginning of European colonial footprints in other parts of the world. But still, India and China were in many, many ways technologically more sophisticated even then. When the Industrial Revolution came, and the key invention of the steam engine being made into an extremely powerful, practical, versatile instrument that could be used for war, for factory production, for transport, and for countless other things, this was the decisive breakthrough to the modern economy. And it happened first in Britain, and then in Western Europe and the United States. And so it was industrialization in the 19th century that was the great, great advantage of the West, the decisive advantage. And it led to European imperialism in the 19th century and growing U.S. imperialism in the 20th century. But very broadly speaking, without going into every nook and cranny of economic history, World War I and World War II shattered many things, ideas, systems, politics, lives, but also the European imperial system, which by the end of World War II was basically on its path of coming to an end by and large. There are still little, there are still colonies around, but not the big ones. India gained independence, Indonesia gained independence, and so forth in the late 1940s, and then onward with the wars of liberation of Vietnam and other places. What happened with independence was these formerly brutalized and colonized places introduced education systems, literacy, infrastructure, and said, hell, we don't want that again. We want to catch up. And this is by and large what has happened. From 1950, instead of what economists would call the age of divergence, where the rich got richer and the poor got snookered and colonized, which was roughly from 1800 to 1950, from 1950 onward, the former colonies began a catching up process, some completely dramatic, others not quite as successful, but broadly in the same path. And China's was the most successful from 1980 to 2020, because growth was compound roughly 10% per year for 40 years. And that's more than a 30-time increase of aggregate output. And in the meantime, China moved up the technology ladder right to the forefront of global technology. This is the single biggest game changer of all, but it's part of a more general process. Now comes your question, how did the BRICS come about as a counterweight to the West? In some sense, nobody liked the Western era of dominance when they were colonized. So I think there's a lot of historical latent resentment anyway. And why not? Because the Western world was a nasty world. It was a racist world. It was a dominating world. It was a greedy world. It was an extractive world. It was a hypocritical world. All of those things absolutely apply. But there was a sense, okay, that's the world, you know, so we don't have to be against all of that. But the United States, to summarize, got pretty obnoxious over the last 40 years. You know, I'm not a fan of U.S. foreign policy. I think it's been utterly nasty and self-defeating. And I say nasty because it's based on wars of choice and regime change operations and sanctions, unilateral sanctions that the U.S. puts on to tell other countries what to do. It's not based on diplomacy. It's based on bossing other countries around, not necessarily its own immediate allies in the West, so-called, but in the rest. And so the U.S. foreign policy has been quite obnoxious. Dozens and dozens of regime change operations, wars of choice, nonstop, CIA-led efforts to topple regimes around the world. The more you know, and by now I know a lot, it's deeply unpleasant, and it doesn't work. It does destabilize other places, but it doesn't serve any U.S. purpose, doesn't raise my security, doesn't raise my wealth. All it did was generate $7 trillion of war costs since 2000, and that was funded basically by borrowing from the U.S. So our debt soared to reach about 100% of GDP because we had stupid wars in Iraq and Syria and Libya and Ukraine, in Afghanistan, for nothing. But the BRICS is a reaction to that too, because the United States has pursued an aggressive hegemonic policy, basically trying to hold on to its dominance, even as the underlying economic reality is something quite different now. And that's what the US doesn't understand. They need to get out of their offices and understand the world. We aren't in a Western-led world anymore. We're not in a U.S.-led world anymore. But the U.S. is trying to hang on, just like France did in North Africa for a while, just like France did in Indochina for a while. But it's an absolutely losing effort. And this is what the BRICS have noted, and actually why there are 36 countries around the table today representing more than half the world population.
Including Turkey, a NATO member, which was a huge development in and of itself. And I wanted to ask you, Professor Sachs, do you believe that BRICS, given how much it's expanding, its popularity, it's even Antonio Guterres was there representing the United Nations, which was really a historic moment in and of itself too. Do you feel that BRICS is going to succeed in doing what many people are wondering about, which is supplanting and creating a new alternative financial architecture and structure to ultimately get away from what Chinese President Xi Jinping, what Russian President Vladimir Putin, and what many countries who are interested in joining BRICS have been talking about, which is the weaponization of the dollar and dollar dominance.
So again, a big question. I have a general point, which is that the U.S. Has been the main hegemon in the world for the basically nearly 80 years since the end of World War II, but that period's over. I personally do not believe that China will be the new hegemon. I think we are now in a truly multipolar world. There will be a number of major powers, the United States remaining one of them, the EU, if it holds together, being one, Russia, China, India, and maybe the African Union in 20 years will look like a geostrategic leader as well. It's not impossible. So I think we're in a multipolar world. I don't think that the West is going away, or I don't think that it's going to succumb to China's dominance, because I don't think, first of all, that China wants dominance. I don't think it's possible for China to be the world hegemon in any event, not in a military sense and not in many other senses. And it's an important footnote to add that China's population today is 1.4 billion, but by the end of the century, it could well be below 1 billion because the fertility rates are so far below replacement level that China's population has peaked and is now declining. And of course, things depend on fertility rates in future decades, but I think it's right to say that the population will decline. It will age in terms of average age or median age. And I don't see China, therefore, wanting or able or motivated or just having to happen that China becomes the new hegemon. The same is kind of true with the dollar. The dollar has been the hegemonic currency, not unrelated to America's political hegemony as well. It will no longer be the hegemonic currency. There will be multiple currencies. I don't think the renminbi will supplant the dollar, but it will absolutely live alongside the dollar as a major world currency. And I doubt that there will be a BRICS currency anytime soon. There may be a BRICS unit of account, like the SDR is a formal unit of account. It's a basket of currencies where the units are defined by the IMF and used in IMF accounting and in some denomination of credits and so forth. And maybe the BRICS will have a similar kind of basket and accounting, and maybe it could show up even in some bonds and in some lending and so forth. But I don't think there will be a unique BRICS currency for quite a while, if ever. So what I think we're moving towards is a multi-currency system, just like we're moving towards a multipolar system. And one of the reasons that the U.S. has accelerated this is essentially the same answer I gave about the geopolitics. The U.S. government has been absolutely obnoxious in how it's misused money. It's a privilege when other countries use your money. You get to borrow very cheap, by the way, even just printing notes that they hold because they're dealing with your currency. So you get what we call seniorage returns. But if you suddenly go out and confiscate the bank holdings of other governments, like we did with Russia, freezing $300 billion of Russian government assets, or you do that with Venezuela, or you do that with Iran, or you do that with Afghanistan, well, there are many ways to transact. You don't have to hold dollars. And if I were not on good terms with the USG as being a different government, I wouldn't hold dollars either. You're on mute, Danny.
Sorry about that. Yes, indeed. Professor Sachs, my last question to you has to do with Israel and this creeping war with Iran. It seems as if Israel has backed off for the time being, given that there were intelligence leaks, U.S. intelligence leaks from a mysterious source, some debate whether it was inside of the Pentagon, inside of Washington's apparatus, intelligence apparatus. But nonetheless, it seems as if Israel might have backed off for now. But there's still Yoav Gallant and Israeli officials talking about how this strike will be hard and it will be damaging. I'm curious on your assessment of what is coming here between Israel and Iran and, of course, the U.S.'s role, given that West Asia is indeed probably at the precipice of and currently on the path of war that's already been so devastating for Gaza and Lebanon.
First, it's important to say that Netanyahu has been campaigning for a U.S. war with Iran at least for 30 years. This has been a pet project of Netanyahu. Netanyahu is one of the world's leading political disaster cases. And his influence over the U.S. has been utterly disastrous for the United States. He played a major role in talking the Bush administration into invading Iraq in 2003 on phony pretenses, no less. And he played a major role in encouraging Obama to try to topple Assad in Syria. The man wants the U.S. to take out Israel's enemies that are opposed to Israel's assertion of what it wants, regional hegemony. It wants to be able to control all of the occupied lands, never give back anything, annex them, settle wherever. And Israel has made lots of enemies because of this. And then Netanyahu's answer is, well, we can't really just fight Hamas and Hezbollah. We have to fight the backers. That means the governments. Well, Israel's big talker. Netanyahu is full of it, really an obnoxious character. But his idea has been to engage the U.S. in Israel's wars. And he's had success in that, except these wars have been complete disasters. And he wants the U.S. to fight a war with Iran now. Iran doesn't want to fight. The U.S. doesn't want to fight. Netanyahu wants to fight. The Israel lobby backs Netanyahu. The Congress gives him 58 standing ovations when that guy comes and appears, rather than the shame that he should have received by the United States. And the Congress never should have invited him to speak in the first place. After all, the special the prosecutor of the ICC recommended his indictment for war crimes. So what's the U.S. Congress doing inviting this guy? Anyway, he's been a complete disaster for the U.S., but also for Israel. And I think Israel, you know, is very lucky if some leak caused it to not attack Iran in a way that would have provoked a major escalation of the war, because Israel's not going to come out well in such a war. Iran can, I said Iraq, I think I meant Iran. Iran can penetrate Israel's Iron Dome. And it can do that with its hypersonic missiles. And it's not going to be pleasant for Israel when they're hitting Tel Aviv or Jerusalem or Haifa or other places. And so the whole campaign that Netanyahu has had for 30 years, instead of going for the two-state solution and a state of Palestine living in peace next door to Israel, instead of going for that, he's gone for control of everything and regime change, but all with the U.S. doing his bidding. And it's a disaster, and it's failed miserably, and he's still at it. And our stupid politicians in Washington are still playing his game to a significant extent, though it's quite clear the Pentagon does not want a war with Iran right now. So maybe Israel got off lucky right now. Maybe somebody sane will prevail in Israel to understand, no, the U.S. is not going to fight your war in Iran, and you, Israel, would pay a terrible, terrible price for having a war with Iran right now.
Yes, indeed. That price, I believe, may be the only thing that's delaying such a development. But Professor,
maybe it'll stop it. If there's somebody rational and honest in Israel, maybe it will stop it.
Played something from Gideon Levy last week where he said the opposition leader was dismayed by the fact that they weren't more violent in their attacks on Iran. That was Danny Haifung's YouTube channel. It was nominally called a de-dollarization of the world economy or something like that. It was about BRICS. It includes Richard Wolff, who talked a little bit about on the show this morning, Economic Update. There was one other person, too. That's a YouTube channel. Danny Haifung, as I mentioned, spelled like the town in North Korea. North Vietnam. I'm going back a ways. And it's time for me to wrap it up, which is probably good. Thanks for listening. Opinions are those of the speakers, not necessarily shared by others here at the station. One more mention of the benefit concert tonight, Alice DeMisele. At First Mennonite Church. This is co-sponsored by WEFT. It's a benefit concert for the Red Cloud Renewable Dome House Project. I'm leaving out the Native American there. RedCloudRenewable.org for more information on that. It's a benefit concert. And opening performer and impresario, I think he put this together, is Kevin Elliott, who also runs a little business that does an underwriting announcement, which we're going to hear right now. Thanks for listening, Radio Free Labor. Raring to go.
Programming at WEFT is brought to you in part by Elliott Counseling Group, who offers compassionate mental health care to individuals of all ages. Elliott Counseling Group serves Central Illinois with in-person and online sessions. More information is available at ElliottCounselingGroup.com. That's E-L-L-I-O-T-T, Counseling Group, no punctuation or spaces.com, or by phone at 217-398-9066.